present are Representative McLean, Representative Swacki, Representative Funholt, Representative Nard, Representative Hanley, and Donnelly are on their way. Before we get into the first item of business, it's my hope that we can move out SCR 10 this morning, and then we'll take up HJR 7, and it's my understanding that on HB 88, the making of possession of marijuana illegal, Representative Hanley and his subcommittee will be meeting on Wednesday to address this, the issue discussed at the last work session, and we'll be we'll discuss then whether it's necessary to schedule an additional work session or bring the bill before committee for a formal hearing. Then also let the record show that Representative Alice Hanley is present. Alice, I was just talking about your scheduled work session on Wednesday regard HB 88, and if you could let us know what comes out of that work session, if you're going to need additional work session, or if you'd like to have the bill brought before the committee. I think one of the things that I might point out to those, I intend to use subcommittees a lot, and they're going to be meaningful. In fact, a good example was the legislation that Representative Hanley and Donnelly worked on the other day, which was an amendment to Kay Brown's. And the press called here and said, well, I said, no, I got a subcommittee working on that. So press talk to them, and the same thing when your subcommittee legislation, I'm going to give the people an opportunity to share in what happens within state affairs. But one of the key things is ultimately we have to be charged with the overall responsibility of scheduling bills and so forth. So I would like very much to have staff working with Dennis, keeping him on top of it, so that you know, we don't just get a committee substitute here and we don't know about it or what have you. That's just to keep things flowing in good order. So, Ann, what I would like an update on HB 13. Are you making progress in that particular area? And
yeah, I think we're making progress. In fact, I talked with Bob Evans this morning. Our subcommittee will be meeting again Thursday at 1 o'clock, Friday at 1 o'clock, to bring all of the members of the committee back together. But we've been working on it.
Okay, so you do not anticipate then that we will be able to bring HB 13 up in any form during this week's work?
No, not until next Tuesday.
Okay. If you could let us know rather specifically, okay. When do you need to know that by?
Oh, I'm working closely with
you. All right, good. I think that's the key thing. I mean, if we can just, we want the committees to function, but the main thing, I want Dennis to know what the committee's doing, particularly so we can schedule the flow of work.
Yeah, we're working with Dennis.
Okay, and I really appreciate the work that the subcommittees are doing on that. I want to thank the members of the public for attending this morning. I see that who will be here testifying on SCR 10? Why don't you come forward?
My name is Dave Gray. I'm a husband made for Senator Kelly, and briefly, Senator would like to thank the chairman for bringing up this resolution at this time. I want to be fairly brief as far as introductions, because I do believe there's some people at the Department of Military Affairs that would also speak to this bill. The letter that Senator Kelly has sent with this bill is pretty well explains its the resolution's generation and the purpose for it. It's basically to honor Lars Johnson for his service to the National Guard when he's established. The second thing, and the reason why we're trying to move this along, is that there's an award ceremony coming up soon where it would be most appropriate that such an honor be conferred. And I guess I would like to stop my remarks at that point, and that I think there might be other people.
General Schaefer, if you're in Anchorage, sir, why don't you go ahead?
Mr. Chairman, this is Chuck Borg. General Schaefer is in Washington, D.C. on business, sir, and he's asked me to take this testimony if it's okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman? Hello?
We hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Colonel Lars Johnson was the first adjutant general of the Alaska National Guard, serving between 1951 and 1953. At the time that he was adjutant general, the rank of colonel was the going rank for the adjutant general in Alaska. Colonel Johnson left the guard in 1953. He's still alive, resides in Oregon. And this action in front of your committee, Mr. Chairman, is to set forth the wheels to allow him to be honorarily promoted to the rank of a major general in a ceremony that will be taking place at Coolis this coming Saturday.
Is there any other testimony?
Not from this end, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody else online who wishes to testify? Is there anybody here in Juneau who wishes to testify further? We have SCR 10 relative to the promotion of Colonel Lars Johnson. Are there any comments or questions from the committee? If not, the chair will accept a motion to move SCR 10 out of committee with individual recommendations.
So moved, Mr. Chairman, and ask for unanimous consent.
It's been moved that SCR 10 move out of committee with individual recommendations. Are there any objections? If not, SCR 10 moves out of committee with individual recommendations. Thank you. Staff points out that on the record I indicated that the Martin Luther King bill was HB 13. Now, let me correct that. That's HB 83. Sorry, mistake. For those of you who regard HB 13, which is the Universal Service Bill, I'm not, any of you that may be testifying today, I'm not going to be hearing that today, but we'll be later on this week. The next item to come before the committee is H.J.R. 7, propose an amendment to the Constitution. officers of the state of Alaska relating to the individual right to keep and bear arms. The prime sponsor of that is Representative Dave Donnelly. Dave, do you wish to comment on the legislation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, ACR 7 simply makes the Alaska Constitution do what the vast majority of Alaskans think it already does, and think the federal Constitution already does. And that, Mr. Chairman, is to protect the individual citizen's right to bear arms, the individual law-abiding citizen, Mr. Chairman. This is not a novel concept. As a matter of fact, Alaska is in a distinct minority among states which do not guarantee an individual right to bear arms. In fact, I think there's only something like 10 to 12 states that do not have constitutional amendments that specify either that the right to bear arms belongs to the individual, to the people, or to a citizen. And I have the research here from House of Research and also a memorandum that I'm going to provide the committee that has every other state's constitutional amendment on the right to bear arms. The Alaska, I think, is similar to Hawaii. We've adopted the United States constitutional language, which has been interpreted implied by in one United States Supreme Court decision and been interpreted by several district courts as only relating to the right to bear arms in the defense of the nation and does not grant an individual right to bear arms. And although there's never been a truly definitive United States Supreme Court case, the recent cases in the district courts and other federal courts certainly has brought it into question whether there is any individual right to bear arms as far as the courts are concerned, the federal courts are concerned, for individuals under the federal constitutional language, which our Constitution parallels. To be more specific, Mr. Chairman, there are 43 states that have amendments to their constitution. Seven states, those amendments specify the right goes to an individual or to a person. 10 states use the term the people, and 17 states use the term citizen. That totals 34 states, and Alaska is one of the eight other states, I guess, that doesn't use any of those words, but rather uses the words militia or another phrase that would associate with a group of people, Mr. Chairman, and not individuals. In no state, and this was the testimony last year, and by the way, Mr. Chairman, this amendment has been ratified by one body of the legislature, I think, for each of the past three legislative sessions, so there's people with a longer historical aspect than me. But I know it has been ratified by the Senate for the last two legislative sessions, and was, did not need approval in the House. But the questions that were asked in last year's lengthy hearings on this legislation in the same committee, basically, people identify concerns that somehow this amendment would change the ability of the state to have any of the existing laws controlling weapons the state of Alaska already has. And the question that's been asked and has not been answered, there could be one simple example of similar language in any of these other, 34 states that have an individual right, Mr. Chairman, where a court struck down a reasonable regulation of firearms. Since that, the response to that was always negative. The opponents of the resolution could not show a single case where that was a fact. And recently, in last November, in response to a new constitutional amendment in the state of West Virginia, there was a case, Mr. Chairman. And I'm sure the opponents of this proposal, and I've heard them already cite that case, Mr. Chairman, but if anything, the West Virginia case just highlights the need for this amendment. Because the West Virginia law that was struck down was so unreasonable, it shows exactly what this constitutional provision is designed to prevent. And I think if anyone appears before this committee and cites that West Virginia law, the question I want them to answer is, do they think that West Virginia law was reasonable? And if it wasn't reasonable, then why shouldn't it have been struck down? And if they feel that West Virginia law was reasonable, then I'd like them to run through the criteria that was set out in that West Virginia law and identify to the committee why they thought those criteria were reasonable, Mr. Chairman, because that law required a person to have be employed for 5 years before they could apply for a permit to own a firearm. It required them to be of temperate character, Mr. Chairman, which is certainly a very subjective criteria. It didn't require even that they'd be able to be charged with a violation of law. We required them to have temperate character. It required them to post a $5,000 bond, I think it was. It required 1 year residency in the state before they could apply for a permit to own one of these firearms. I mean, basically, it's everything that we think the Constitution should prohibit, unreasonable regulation of arms to law-abiding citizens. So I think it's a perfect example of why we need this constitutional amendment, Mr. Chairman. And some people have tried to twist that case and say that the people in West Virginia were told that their constitutional amendment wouldn't have any impact on existing laws, and thus extrapolate from a case that actually supports our position and try to use it to say, well, because people here are saying that the purpose of this amendment was not to change any existing laws, that that somehow spills over into this argument. And I think that's a total fallacy, Mr. Chairman, because obviously the West Virginia law was unreasonable. And there's nothing similar to that West Virginia law in the books in Alaska at this time. But if there was, Mr. Chairman, I sure hope that if any legislature ever sees fit to do that, that we'll have a constitution that will prevent that. And to do that, we're going to need something similar to HCR 7 or a derivative of it. And I sure hope that it's in place if that ever occurs. It's interesting, there's been a modern movement towards these type of constitutional amendments. Nebraska just recently adopted by constitutional referendum an amendment, which means that their people placed it before the people through the initiative process to add to their constitution. Alaska doesn't possess that capability. Our people can't put constitutional amendments before themselves for ratification. They depend on us, Mr. Chairman. And all HR 7 does is place this proposal before the voters. And in essence, it simply leaves the question to the voters of the people of Alaska. And I'd like to know what's so wrong with that. I mean, why do the opponents of this amendment fear the will of the people of Alaska? I'm willing to leave this question up to the people of Alaska, to have them debate it in public and open, and let them make the decision. Why are they so afraid to let the people make that decision, Mr. Chairman? And that's why I strongly support HGR 7. I think the people should be entitled to make a decision of whether they want to protect themselves from overly restrictive government. And with that, I'll end my remarks.
Thank you, Representative Donnelly. So who do we have out on teleconference that wishes to testify?
I believe you've got the names highlighted in blue right there.
Chuck Borg need not testify.
He just testified, so it would be the next person again.
Louis Bernardino.
Ben Cardina and Dwayne Lennon.
Okay, all right. I understand we have people that wish to testify on HJR 7. Louis Ben Cardino, would you come in, please, sir?
I've been with Mr. Donnelly, and I feel he puts up a pretty good argument. The biggest problem that I see...
Could you give your name and address for the record, please, sir?
Okay. Chief Louis Bankardino, Seward, Alaska, Box 167, 99664.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead. Excuse the interruption.
I've been in police work for approximately 20-some years, and I can understand what Mr. Donnelly's trying to get across. The only problem is that most of the time the general public gets the information that, like Mr. Donnelly is putting across, they don't really get the other side of the story of what really can happen when we do make changes in their constitution. Right now, I haven't heard anybody other than the NRA complain about what's happened to our citizens in this state. We've had this law up in statehood on gun control, and it doesn't interfere with our hunters. It doesn't interfere with the general public having the ability to have 1 or 10 weapons in their home. The only thing it does control is that people cannot walk around with a concealed weapon walking into public places such as a bar or a bank with a weapon underneath their jacket. Other than that, I don't see any real problem with what's happening in the last 20 years here. Now, once we open up our Constitution, I think Mr. Donnelly will find out that he'll have a lot of opposition, and it may be something that would be put in there that none of us would like. And I feel that it's a good law that we have now, and I don't think we should change things. We have no problems. The general public are used to it. They understand it. And why change something that is working? And that's my feeling on the HJR-7.
Thank you, sir. We also have Dwayne Udlin online. Would you go ahead, please, sir?
Can you hear me okay?
You're coming through fine. Your name and address for the record, please, sir.
My name is Dwayne Udlin. I'm the Deputy Chief of the Anchorage Police Department. The address is 4501 South McGraw, Anchorage, Alaska. I'm testifying today to represent the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, of which I'm Vice President. Our position has been and continues to be that we are opposed to a change in our Constitution. I'd like to point out that as a group, we are not anti-gun. We are not pushing handgun control. We have not even communicated with the organization Handgun Control. We, a large number of our members are hunters, sportsmen, handgun enthusiasts, and we share much of the concern that many people have that these freedoms not be limited. Our position is really quite simple. We believe that the Alaska Constitution is working just fine. When you take that amendment, couple it with the interpretations that the Supreme Court, where they have interpreted many issues much more broadly than the federal Constitution. We have the right to privacy clause in our Constitution as it now stands. We think that the citizens and their rights to purchase and own firearms are well protected now within the state, and we see no reason to change that. The language that has been offered up by the supporters of the amendment appears to us to be very restrictive, that it would certainly open the door to change laws that exist on the books as they are now, and quite possibly prevent any laws from ever being passed that need to be passed. If you take that language that is in the before the committee right now, and you add that in to our Constitution along with the privacy issue, we're very concerned as to what direction the courts could take. It's my hope that this amendment will not be passed by the legislature. To answer Mr. Donnelly's concern about why can't this be debated in the public, we're certainly not taking the position that the public can't figure the issue out What we are concerned with is that the public will not be given the whole story, that if this amendment does pass out of the legislature and goes before the public, we're very concerned that there's going to be financial backing behind it that will just literally swamp the news media, and the advertisements will be so pro this amendment that we're afraid the truth will never come out. I might add, I've been asked, I've talked with a number of members from the National Rifle Association, and they were a little bit baffled as to why law enforcement was so silent on this issue when it was first brought up 3 or 4 years ago. I myself have been on the legislative committee for the Chiefs Association for 6 years, and we actually looked at that amendment when it was first introduced about 4 years ago, and at first, we didn't really look into it, but we all looked at it in the meeting that I was there, and a number of us looked at it and said, well, gee, we all believe in the right to keep and bear arms, and so we didn't question it any further. It wasn't until about a year and a half ago that we really started looking into what the ramifications of changing our Constitution are that we then became concerned as to what would be taking place. So that's how we arrived at the position we're at now, and our silence in the past was simply, in a way, an agreement that we believe in the principles, but we don't think changing the Constitution is the way to go. That's all I have to offer. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, sir. Representative Donnelly?
Yes. Has the Anchorage Municipal Police Employees Association taken a position on this amendment?
I talked with a member of the legislative committee last week. I was told that they were going to be opposed to that, but I haven't seen anything in writing.
So there hasn't been a vote by their legislative committee, or there hasn't been an actual position taken?
Well, that's my understanding that they have. I just haven't seen it in writing.
Are you going to be participating in that decision, or can you get us a copy of whatever they decide?
I don't participate in that decision at all. The Anchorage Police Association is separate from any organization that I'm involved with, and while they certainly listen to my opinion and to my concerns, they make up their own mind.
Okay, so your testimony today is that you can inform somebody that they have already taken a position in opposition to this?
Which organization?
That's what I've been told, yes.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else online who wishes to testify on HJR7? If not, we will come back to Juno, and those who had signed up to testify, Laurie Otto.
Are we still on time?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Laurie Otto. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. As you are probably aware from the memorandum that I prepared that's contained in your packet, the Department of Law does not believe that a constitutional amendment in this area is necessary at this time, particularly in the form as it's presently before you. I guess I'd like to start by saying that, by going to the point where Representative Donnelly started, and that's his statement that the purpose or the intent of the amendment is to simply state clearly in the Alaska Constitution what the vast majority of Alaskans think they already have as a right in this area, and that is to give individual Alaskans the right to bear arms. That is consistent with the legal analyses that have been before the committee in previous years. Although the Department of Law has consistently taken a position in opposition to the amendment, the department has never before this year attempted to analyze or to state in specific language why it objects to the amendment, why it thinks it would create a problem, and support that with cases. As a result of the department not doing that, the only information before the committee was provided by the National Rifle Association. And although I agree that Mr. Dowlett, who's testified frequently in Alaska on this amendment, has a great deal of experience in evaluating firearms laws, I think it's also important to realize that he's a very strong advocate for Alaska and all the other states in the United States adopting a very broad-based constitutional provision granting individuals the right to bear arms. What that analysis ignores and what is sort of missing in the equation that Representative Donnelly gave to you is that the Alaska Constitution is unique in a number of ways. One, we have a specific right to privacy that our court has interpreted extremely broadly. I know that this committee's been grappling with the issues presented by the court's interpretation of the Privacy Amendment and how it relates to an individual's right to use marijuana in their own home. We in the law enforcement community, since I represent the prosecutor's offices across the state and the police chiefs that you've just heard testify, have to deal on a daily basis with the court's broad interpretation of search and seizure laws based on the combined effect of our constitutional provision against unreasonable searches and seizures and the Privacy Amendment. We see a wide variety of broad interpretations of our Constitution. I've outlined them in my memorandum, so I won't go over them at length unless the committee has questions. But we are extremely concerned about not only the broad language of this particular constitutional amendment, which I should note is there is only one state in the United States that has language this broad, and that's Rhode Island, and they've never had a court decision interpreting their constitutional amendment. But not only because of the broad language of this amendment, but because of the equal protection analysis that our court applies that's broader than other states and the federal government, and because of our Privacy Amendment that's broader than other states and the federal government. And I've heard a lot of people say in different contexts, no other state has ever struck down a law based on this kind of constitutional amendment. I take issue with that statement, and I'll explain why in a minute. But very clearly, no other state in the country, even those with privacy amendments to their constitution, have ever said that individuals have a right to smoke marijuana in their own home. We are unique in this area. And so that if we, who practice law in Alaska and deal with the constitutional interpretations of the Alaska court, are saying, gee, it doesn't really matter in a lot of different circumstances what courts in other states have done. Our court has never shown any hesitancy or shyness in giving expanded interpretations where they believe that is what the intent of the people was or what they think the clear language of the amendment states, which is where we're concerned in this area. Going then to the point of no other states have struck down laws, I don't really think that's true. In Colorado, for example, based on their constitutional provision protecting the right to bear arms, their court said that it is a defense to a charge of being a felon in possession of a firearm, that you possessed a firearm for legitimate purposes of self-defense. In Alaska, felons cannot have firearms whether or not they have a right, they feel that they have a need to protect themselves against anybody. It's a flat-out prohibition. And if a similar defense were read into the law by our court, as was done in Colorado, we believe that it effectively strikes down our felon in possession law. Because if somebody has a gun in their car, a gun in their home, they're charged with felon in possession, they claim self-defense, it then becomes the burden of the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a person did not have the gun for self-defense, if the Colorado interpretation were applied in Alaska. That's an almost impossible burden to overcome, and we feel like it takes all of the teeth, if not effectively invalidates our felon in possession law. The other thing that we feel would happen in this state, and again, there haven't really been any cases on it, in large part because if you go back and look at the cases on felon in possession laws that have been decided under different state constitutions, and I talk about a lot of them in my memorandum to you. Those states have laws that prohibit violent felons from having firearms. Again, Mr. Dowlett, who's the National Rifle Association General Counsel, who's written several law review articles about firearms regulations, has put out a law review article that says, of course, if this kind of amendment were adopted, you could only prohibit people who've been convicted of violent felonies from having firearms, people who were convicted of crimes that were common law felonies. Well, of course, drug offenses are not common law felonies, and they're not commonly thought of as being violent felonies. Bootlegging offenses, same thing. We have a number of laws in Alaska where that wouldn't fall into the category of being a violent felony, yet we prohibit all felons from having firearms in that state, in this state. That's a choice that's been made by the legislature. And we believe that our court, looking at our felon in possession law that includes both violent and nonviolent felonies, in light of a constitutional amendment granting every individual in the state the right to bear arms, we do not believe that our court would find that law to be constitutional. We would have to show a compelling state interest in prohibiting nonviolent felons from having firearms. We don't believe that that showing could be made. The point of the West Virginia case, and this goes, and I guess I'm responding in part to questions that Representative Donnelly was raising, really is, what value do statements made before legislative committees have in terms of later court interpretations of constitutional provisions? And in West Virginia, and there's documentary evidence to support this, the representatives of the National Rifle Association and people who were supporting the constitutional amendment came before the legislative body and said repeatedly, this will not have an effect on existing West Virginia laws. Our licensing laws are constitutional, our felon in possession laws are constitutional, our cease and desist, our carrying a concealed weapon laws are constitutional. When it passed the legislature, they took out newspaper advertisements saying, we will keep all our firearms laws. This will not have any effect. And the point is, whether or not the law was terrible or wonderful, the representation that the people had before them and that the legislature considered was that it wouldn't affect existing laws. As in Alaska in previous years, nobody in West Virginia came back to the legislature and did a constitutional analysis of the effect of the amendment, other than the National Rifle Association. And so that then, when it went to court, although people did say, this might affect existing laws. We're concerned about its effect on existing laws. When they went to court, the people who were arguing to strike down the law in West Virginia said, yeah, it's true that all the people who were supporting the amendment said that that it wouldn't affect existing laws, but all the people who were opposing it said that it would affect existing laws, and the legislature chose not to follow their advice and chose not to add language retaining the ability to regulate, and so we reached the conclusion that it does have the effect of striking down existing laws, and of course the court agreed and did strike down some laws. I think, or I hope, that I've made my point. I'm more than glad to work with anybody at any time in going over the cases and copying the cases and providing additional backup to what's in my memorandum, or to work with the committee to come up with language that would retain the ability of the Alaska legislature to regulate firearms. The only thing, if I can say one more thing, the one thing I haven't mentioned is that you also have to consider not just existing laws, but the effect on future laws. And I know that Representative Hanley, for example, has contacted me about a couple concerns of the Anchorage Police Department in relation to firearms, and maybe if somebody is violating a domestic violence writ and they're trespassing in violation of a domestic violence writ and they have a dangerous weapon or a firearm with them, that's probably a more serious crime, especially since most of our homicides in the state are handgun-related and in a familial setting, and that you also have to consider not just existing laws, but laws that you may want to put on the books later.
Thank you very much. Are there any comments or questions from the committee? Representative Donnelly?
Yeah. I think there's no doubt that the NRA people
or an advocate for the lesser control of the usage of firearms or possession of firearms in the United States. But the fact is that you're an advocate on the other side, too, here. Just because they're an advocate doesn't taint them any more than the administration being an advocate, because before you even started working on your memorandum here, your superior, who's a member of the Criminal Justice Task Force, took a position in opposition to this. So their opposition from your superior came before you ever even started to work on this memorandum. So we're all advocates for a position, and that should be recognized. I want to ask you this question and see if what your opinion is on this. Now, since the federal district courts have said that there's no individual right to bear arms under the federal constitutional language, and we have identical language, and since the Attorney General's office several years back produced an AG's opinion that said we have no individual right to bear arms for the citizens of Alaska and Alaska, does your department change its position now? Do you now say that our Constitution doesn't guarantee individual right for the citizens of Alaska to keep and bear arms?
Through the chair.
Go ahead.
Representative Donnelly, there is an Attorney General's opinion that was rendered in the context of a landlord-tenant dispute discussing what landlords and tenants can contractually agree to that touched on the right to bear arms. There has never been, until this memorandum that's in your packet right now, a comprehensive analysis of the Alaska right to bear arms by the Attorney General's office. So do I think that somebody who looked at an issue in one context, touched on something tangentially and didn't give it a lot of thought, do I think that that is the equivalent of an Attorney General's opinion on the individual right to bear arms? No, I don't. And no, I don't think that there's been a change in position in the way that you're describing. There are federal district court cases that say language similar to Alaska's does not give an individual right to bear arms. There are also cases that say the opposite. There's substantial law review support for the opposite conclusion. None of those cases have been interpreted in the context of a state like Alaska, where we have an individual right to privacy that our court uses to bootstrap constitutional protections into broader areas. So our conclusion is that it's not real clear to us. I don't think that we can say definitively that our court would interpret the existing amendment as giving an individual right to bear arms in all circumstances. On the other hand, I don't think that you can reach the opposite conclusion either. And I think there's substantial support for the position that our amendment would be interpreted broadly.
There was a recent case that involved the question of the individual right to bear arms. I think it had to do with, like, other than firearms. But did your department take a position in that case in your briefing regarding the individual right to bear arms under the state constitution?
I'm not familiar with the case you're referring to.
And there was an Alaska Supreme Court case where the Attorney General's department defended some of the statutory law. I was just wondering if they took a position in that case.
I'm not aware of any case that discusses the constitutional right to bear arms in Alaska. If you are, I'd very much like to see it, but I spend a lot of time looking into here. I've never run across a case that analyzes that issue.
Yeah, it was more expansive. It didn't deal with firearms. It was a non-firearms case, but it did deal with the right to bear arms. It was about 2 or 3 years ago. I wanted to review the Supreme Court of Virginia's analysis and see if you have some disagreement with it here. On page 16 of their decision, the Virginia Supreme Court says, "Our research has revealed that courts throughout the country have recognized that the constitutional right to keep and bear arms is not absolute, and these courts have uniformly upheld the police power of the state through its legislature to impose reasonable regulatory control over the state constitutional right to bear arms in order to promote the safety and welfare of the citizens." It cites pursued by means of broadly stifle the exercise of this right where the governmental purpose can be more narrowly achieved. Does your analysis conflict with that analysis in any way?
Well, Representative Donnelly, I don't think that you're really giving people the whole story when you read a laundry list like that. And I'll tell you why. You said earlier that 42 states have constitutional protections about the right to bear arms. Alaska's one of those states. If you look at the charts, Alaska's one of those states.
Right.
The states have broadly varying language. Most of them, I think one of the, I wasn't paying attention to all the cases, but one of them was New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
As if, for instance, New Mexico's constitutional provision says, no law shall abridge the right of the citizen to keep and bear arms for security and defense, for lawful hunting and recreational use, and for other lawful purposes, but nothing herein shall be held to permit the carrying of concealed weapons. Courts, when they look at these issues, most often say, we have the right to regulate carrying concealed weapons because our Constitution specifically grants that right. We have the right to regulate arms because our Constitution says something like Illinois that says subject only to the police power, the right of the individual citizen to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So that there is no broad language in any other state other than Rhode Island, which has never interpreted its Constitution. Rhode Island does not have a privacy provision like our state does. You can't isolate one particular constitutional provision and say, because it's kind of the same as another state's, our court's going to interpret it the same. We have a different standard of equal protection. We have a different right to privacy. We have a different court. And I don't think that you can fairly draw the conclusion that because a state that says in its constitution, subject only to the police power, the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed, and equate that with a state that says, absolutely, the right to bear arms shall be protected and not be infringed by the state or a political subdivision. So you're mixing apples and oranges in my mind.
Mr. Chairman, the West Virginia court, which, as far as I know, is the most recent analysis of this by the Supreme Court of this issue, also refers to analysis in West Virginia sites, it's on page 17 of the decision. It goes through the 13-stage, they're citing as being similar to West Virginia's statute, rather broad, unrestricted rights to bear arms for the defense of self and the state, with the exception of Vermont, which imposes no significant regulation. Remaining jurisdictions regulate the ownership and use of arms in general, particularly handguns. And they go on to point out that it's widely accepted, and they're citing a bunch of cases here again. I imagine some of them are similar. And granted, I'm sure that some of the language in these amendments, which are all contained here, all the states' languages, are somewhat different. But they all say that it's a widely accepted practice that states can regulate that. I agree with you that precisely as to the amendment before the committee, Rhode Island's the only other state, and Rhode Island may not have a right, specified right to privacy as we do, but there's been no testimony there's been any problem in Rhode Island specifically, and I'd be interested on the specific analysis you would use to extend the right to privacy into the way you think a court would think that in the greater context, and it's real clear from also these decisions that the state has police power, and the constitutional interpretations of police power expand to the good of the people also. And if there's been a reasonable law that regulating the bearing of arms, how you think the right to privacy would negate that reasonable law? Because even in the marijuana case that you gave as an example, the court said that the regulation of marijuana, absent any showing that there was a danger, was unreasonable. That's a question.
To the chair. Right now in Alaska, somebody who's been convicted of a felony offense cannot have a firearm, a concealable firearm. They can have rifles and they can have shotguns. They can't have concealable firearms anywhere in their homes, in their cars, on their persons. They're flat out prohibited from having firearms. People have a constitutional right to privacy in their homes. People have a constitutional right, if this is passed, possess firearms, that means that the state would have to make a very strong showing, a compelling state interest, like you need to do with marijuana in the home, for continuing the law that prohibits felons from having firearms. If somebody's convicted of a nonviolent felony, what is the compelling state interest that the state could show to say that they should not be able to have a firearm in their home? That's how we think it would interrelate.
Okay. I think I understand your line of reasoning. It's a good question. What is the compelling state interest to prohibit someone like that? Probably isn't one.
Thank you very much. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Are there any other questions from any of the members? If not, thank you very much, Laurie, for your testimony. Gail Horetsky?
Horetsky.
Beg pardon, Gail?
Horetsky.
Gail Horetsky. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gail Horetsky. I'm the Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Public Safety. Commissioner Arthur English very much wanted to be here today, Mr. Chairman, but unfortunately was out of town. He's returning this morning, but not in time because of plane schedule to be able to attend this meeting. He asked me to attend on his behalf, and I hope that you have in your packet the position paper of the Department of Public Safety on this issue. Briefly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to echo some of the comments that Deputy Chief Udlin made earlier, and I believe the Chiefs of Police have made an written statement to you regarding this proposed constitutional amendment. We don't believe that there's a problem, and if there's no problem, why fix it? It's back to the same, if it ain't broke, don't tamper with it. Alaska has the most liberal firearms laws of any state in the Union. Vermont is close, but those two have the most liberal laws of any state in the Union. No one's right to keep and bear arms in the state of Alaska has been interfered with unconstitutionally. The regulations that are on the books right now in the state of Alaska deal with such things as possession by a minor without parental consent, possession of prohibited weapons, that is like submachine guns and things like that, sawed-off shotguns. They deal with giving weapons to intoxicated people. They deal with whether or not you can have a gun in a bar. All of those laws were passed by this legislature as an exercise of the reasonable public safety of all citizens. It's a balancing of a person's right to keep a firearm versus do we want drunks walking down the street shooting whoever they feel like. Now, obviously we don't. That's an absurd example. But that's why you adopt laws prohibiting felons, prohibiting carrying concealed weapons, prohibiting intoxicated people from possession of firearms. I have not heard anyone, from the police departments to the Department of Law, and certainly not the Department of Public Safety, object to the stated purpose of this amendment, and that is to make clear that the right to keep and bear arms in the state of Alaska is an individual right. It's possible that it already is, because our court has never spoken on that issue. But no one to whom I have ever spoken on this issue objects to that stated principle. The objection of the law enforcement community and the people in the state that are concerned with public safety is that the state's right, your right as legislators, to reasonably regulate the possession and use of firearms be retained, pure and simple. That is our only point. And what we are saying to you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is the only foolproof way to be sure that you retain your right to reasonably regulate in the interest of public safety is to say so and to amend the language of this proposed constitutional amendment to say, subject to reasonable police powers, except maybe reasonably regulated by law. You choose whatever language you want, and we would certainly be glad to work with you in the crafting of that language. But the only way for you to know for sure that you're not striking down felon possession laws, that that you're not striking down laws that serve a legitimate public purpose is to say so. And I would very strongly urge you to consider the welfare of the people in your communities in terms of the need to keep firearms out of the hands of certain dangerous people or at certain dangerous times or places. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Donnelly?
Yeah. The testimony from the Department of Law was that even with this language, it seems like, and with the privacy clause considered an equal protection clause, as long as the state showed a compelling reason for the regulation, that it'd be constitutional. What's the difference between, and you're saying that there should be a reasonable standard, is what I'm interpreting you as saying. We want a reasonable standard, not a compelling reason. What's the difference between those two?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Donnelly, the legislature can reasonably regulate a profession or a person's behavior, and that is a lower standard than a compelling state interest for something. I think that's the easy answer. For example, you may feel that there is no compelling state interest in prohibiting the possession of firearms by a convicted felon if he or she was convicted of a nonviolent offense, a drug offense, for example. On the other hand, I think that the legislature, the past legislature's decision that we want to prohibit all felons from possession of firearms, regardless of the particular felony for which they were convicted, is a legitimate exercise of public policy making. There were good reasons, I presume, why that decision was made. Now, that decision can be changed, and the felon in possession law can be amended tomorrow if it's the wish of this body to do so. But constitutional justification is a higher standard than reasonable regulation of society's conduct by the deliberative body of the legislature.
Representative Donnelly?
Okay, so you've given us one example of felons who were convicted of nonviolent crimes being prohibited from owning handguns. Can you give us any more examples of things that in the existing law you feel are reasonable but would not meet a compelling interest test?
Mr. Chairman, it's very difficult to answer that question, Representative Donnelly, because when you look to the laws of other states, as Ms. Otto pointed out, just about every constitutional provision is different. And so the language differs, so therefore the interpretation of that language differs. And a law that would be upheld in one state would not necessarily be upheld in the other state, depending on the specific language of that constitution.
Wait a second here. The argument was that the other state specifically allowed certain categories.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to have any impact on what's a compelling state interest and what's reasonable. Those categories are exempted out. If they're specified, then if it's reasonable, it's okay. So that's not a logical argument. Let's go back to my question. Let's identify the difference between reasonable and compelling interest and any other categories of existing law that would fall in.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Donnelly, I can't tell you how our legislature is going to call this. I would never have predicted in a million and a half years that that Raven decision would come out the way it did. I guess I don't think like some of those judges do. To answer your question, I hope, we have laws, for example, that prohibit the possession of a firearm by a minor unless his or her parent consents. Now, is there a compelling state interest for that? Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know what the court would say about that. We have laws that prohibit giving a weapon to a felon. We also have ones that prohibit the felon from having it, but we have laws that prohibit giving it to the felon. Is there a compelling state interest there? What about the law that prohibits the possession of a firearm if a serial number has been filed off? Is that a compelling state interest? I don't know. Do you? Does anybody? How do we know what our court is going to do? And it's surprising to me that the proponents of this language are apparently willing to wholesale take the power to pass gun laws, regulation of firearms in Alaska, and hand it over to the Supreme Court with no guidance as to how they're eventually going to come out. I mean, if I was a legislator and I had confidence in my ability to make the right decisions regarding public interest, I would want to retain my power to carefully craft and amend laws as the needs arose over the years. I wouldn't want to hand that over to the court.
So you're saying that if you were a legislator, you would oppose the constitutional right to privacy?
Mr. Chairman, if I were a legislator, I would not vote for this language for the right to keep and bear arms.
Well, no, your argument extends to all constitutional protections that we give the people also. I mean, you don't think we should have an equal protection clause? You think the legislature should just bear it on their own responsibility and make sure the laws equally protect the people? Do you trust the legislature just to do that on their own?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Donnelly, I did not say that. I don't think that's a fair characterization.
Well, that's
what
your argument was. We shouldn't limit the power of the legislature. We should be able to trust ourselves.
I think that the present constitutional amendment, present constitutional language works fine. I think that this legislature has acted responsibly in this area under the present language. I am concerned with you foreclosing your future colleagues from exercising the same responsible judgment about gun regulation that this body has shown in the past.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to go back to the beginning of your presentation. You stated that the thing's not broke, so let's not fix it, right? And that seems to be one of the overriding themes of the argument against these provisions. But I think that, you know, I mean, it really begs the question, because the question here is not what's right now. The question here is for the protections for the future for citizens of Alaska. And you're supposing that because we have a particular political climate at this moment, that that's going to carry on forever. And because we have a political climate at this moment, we shouldn't be concerned with the protections for future Alaskans. And I think that's poor public policy. That's what constitutions are all about, to protect the future as well as the present. And that's why this amendment's being offered. Not for a particular problem at this time, but for the future of the state of Alaska and the future of our citizens. And that's why we have constitutions, and I think it's a very appropriate purpose.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I agree with Representative Donnelly's statement, and my concern is to protect the state in the future and to preserve the rights of the legislature to reasonably regulate. If, for example, the legislature decided 10 years from now or 5 years from now to pass a law that prohibited the possession of loaded firearms in a schoolyard, which we do not now do, but I think would be a reasonable exercise of the public policy power if this legislative body chose to do that. I am concerned that this language, if it is adopted, would foreclose future legislators from making those kind of reasonable regulations of firearms to protect children in the schoolyard. The Stockton case leaps to mind, but I think there have been about 5 of them this last couple of years.
Chairman, I think that's an outrageous appeal to emotions here on your part, because clearly I think any reasonable person could find a compelling interest in the state to prohibit those type of firearms in the schoolyard. And if you have that, I don't think, I certainly have a higher regard of our judiciary than to assume that they wouldn't find a compelling interest there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dialogue is big risk.
Next witness, Barbara Miklos indicated that you were observing. Is that correct?
I think she had to leave, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Paul Grant.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Grant. I'm here, wearing two hats today. I represent the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, and I also have some remarks to make on my own behalf, which may not necessarily be completely consistent with the Alaska Civil Liberties Union position, and I hope, as the committee listens to what I have to say, that that distinction is clear, and if it's not, I hope the committee will stop me and ask the question. The Alaska Civil Liberties Union is presently considering, the Board of Directors is presently considering this resolution on my suggestion that the resolution presents some issues of personal autonomy, personal privacy that are unique to Alaska. Now, in historical context, the American Civil Liberties Union has never found or supported an individual right to bear arms in the federal constitutions. And ACLU policy specifically states that fact, that there there is not found to be an individual right to bear arms in the federal constitution, nor does national ACLU policy find any civil liberties interest in affirmative gun control. And that, in fact, was an issue that was before the ACLU at one time. And if I'm not mistaken, the organization initially felt that prevention of violent crime might justify, as a civil liberties issue, affirmative gun control. That stance was abandoned, and at this point, the national policy is that is neutral on both sides of the issue. In other words, finds that there is no affirmative right to bear arms, but does not find any civil liberties issue in affirmative gun control. My impetus for bringing the issue before the Alaska, and in the absence of a national policy, the Alaska affiliate is free to adopt its own policy on the issue. My impetus for bringing it before the body is a consideration of the Alaskan lifestyle and of other Alaskan constitutional provisions, which seem to me to speak in favor of the right that is set out in the resolution, and which clearly does not presently exist in the Alaska Constitution. And those considerations are our isolation from our geographical isolation from the rest of the country, and our separation from the contiguous states, in terms of our ability to support ourselves were there to be some disruption of either through natural causes or through a war, were there to be some disruption of our supply lines to the rest of the country, I think we would very quickly see an increased importance in the value of firearms to Alaskans. I think our recreational tendencies in this state, our recreational activities, center much more frequently around firearms, both for self-protection in the wilderness and for hunting purposes. So it was my feeling, my personal feeling, that those considerations justified the Alaska affiliate of the ACLU in taking another look at the issue and in considering whether to affirmatively support the resolution. We have not yet acted on that. There has been some debate back and forth among board members, and I would relate to you some of the concerns that have been expressed, because while the affiliate hasn't yet taken a formal position, I think the concerns that have been expressed might be of some interest to the committee. The primary concern is the one that was expressed by the previous witnesses, and that is the possible effect of this legislation on the ability of the legislature or of local governments to regulate the use of firearms. And as a personal matter, and again, this is not a position of the ACLU, but as a personal matter, I think it would be appropriate for the committee to consider the addition of language to the resolution along the lines of subject to the police power, subject to state and local regulation, language that was suggested by the previous witnesses. I think that language would find no objection, or should find no objection among supporters of the resolution, because, as they have said, it is not intended to affect those areas. And I think the comfort level of a lot of people who support the right, who feel there should be a right, would be increased with this legislation if that language were in there. And I don't think that it has any, I don't see any downside to it in terms of the protection that the amendment would afford as far as the right to keep and bear arms is concerned. I think that's all the comments I'll have today, other than to say that as the organization considers the issue and as the debate progresses, I would look forward to another opportunity to address this or some other committee if we're able to take a position on the bill.
Thank you. sir. Are there any questions? The next witness is Ruth Andrews.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Rip Andrews, and I'm employed by the National Rifle Association as their field representative in Alaska. I'd like to apologize first to a couple members of this committee. I'm going to repeat a lot of the history of this resolution before you. You've sat on other committees, as you have, Mr. Chairman, you've heard some of this before, but I think we have to put it back into the record. Clarify what we're talking about, a little bit about the history of why we're here on this amendment. And to set the record straight right off the bat, this amendment didn't arrive from the, or start with the national level of NRA. It began with the 25,000 members of the association here in Alaska. We're talking about Alaskans that have the concern now. As I think the majority and mainstream of Alaskans presently believe, we all felt and thought that we had a constitutional right to individually own and bear firearms. And in the packets that I've handed out, you'll see the Attorney General's opinion of 1983 from Norman Gorsuch at that time that reversed that thought anyway. And it caused some alarm, and we went back to the minutes of the Alaska Constitutional Convention, and Mr. Chairman, there's no record, no written record of the committee meeting on this. So I went to the chairman of that committee at that time, Senator Vic Fisher, and asked him why there was no minutes about this particular section of the Constitution. And his answer to me was there was no comment because it's worked for about 175 years, and therefore we just put it in. Now, the Alaska Constitution does track, word for word, the Second Amendment of the Federal Constitution. The only difference is punctuation in a couple of places. And we were quite surprised with the Attorney General's opinion in 1983 that upset the apple cart. And you can read that for yourself in your packet. Since that time, and this is the fifth year that this amendment, similar amendment, has been before the Alaska legislature, and in the opinion of our general counsel, and I guess I should also set the record straight, I guess I'm the first one to testify today that is not an attorney. I would like to just point out what the amendment would do in the opinion of our general counsel. If a constitutional amendment was approved by the legislature and the voting public to amend Article 1, Section 19, this amendment would not change any existing state statutes that regulate firearms. It would not change the existing state statute that disallows the concealed carry of firearms. It would not allow a convicted felon to own or possess a handgun. It would not allow a person to possess prohibited weapons unless they are lawfully possessed in accordance with the National Firearms Act. It would not allow a person to possess a loaded firearm in any place where intoxicating liquor is sold. In short, the state of Alaska would be able to continue to reasonably regulate the ownership and use of firearms as it has for the past 30 years. What would happen? The amendment would, if passed, clarify the law-abiding citizen's individual right to own and lawfully use firearms without undue harassment or unconstitutional blanket prohibition of firearms, such as those enacted in Morton Grove, Illinois, contrary to the Illinois Constitution. We've heard a lot of discussion, and I think there's some general agreement on both sides of this issue that there's really no problem with the keeping and the bearing of firearms. It's the use part. We have law enforcement organizations that are concerned that it will repeal or in some way amend drastically these existing state statutes on firearms. For 5 years, I found myself in a very uncomfortable position because we've had in our association a long and traditional relationship of working with law enforcement, and I find myself uncomfortable because I'm on the other side taking a different interpretation at this time. Our general counsel, who's got a long, long history of looking at firearm laws throughout the country, has assured myself and other members here in Alaska that nothing will change if this passes, amendment passes. Nothing will change as far as the state's ability to reasonably regulate the ownership and possession of firearms. This amendment would not, in our opinion, change the ability of municipalities to, through local ordinance, regulate the discharge of firearms. If you're a resident of Shevac with a very small population, it may be safe to shoot down the main street of Shevac. But of course, you can't do that on 4th Avenue on Anchorage. So there are differing needs throughout the state, and that's recognized in the ability to of each community to regulate the discharge. In your packet, there is an analysis for your consideration to read on the constitutional guarantee to keep and bear arms that was prepared by the general counsel of our organization, Mr. Robert Dowlett. And throughout the research on this, Mr. Dowlett has pointed out that of the 42 states that have constitutional provisions guaranteeing the individual right to own and bear firearms, that there's no case law that would upset that or change that relationship. Today we've heard some discussion about the most current opinion, which is the West Virginia opinion. The National Rifle Association entered into this case, and the statute I'm talking about is West Virginia Code 61-7-2, 1988. The reason that this was overturned by the constitutional provision is that this statute was much too broad, and in effect became unconstitutional in the requirements of its citizens to own and to lawfully bear firearms. I'd just like to read a few of the things that you haven't heard about the West Virginia opinion. According to this statute that's just been overturned, any person desiring to obtain a state license to carry any such weapon, as mentioned in the first section of this article, within one or more counties in the state, shall first publish a notice setting forth his name, resident and occupation, and then on a certain day, he will apply to the circuit court of his county for such a state license. Such notice shall be published as a Class 1 legal advertisement in compliance with the provisions of Article 3, Chapter 59 of this code, and the publication area for such publication shall be in the county for which publication shall be the county in which such person resides. Such notice shall be at least 10 days before application is made. After publication of such notice and the time stated in such notice, an application to such court, it may grant such license to such person in the following manner, to wit. And I've just started to begin on the restrictions here. The applicant shall file within such court his application in writing, duly verified, which application shall show as basic qualifications as follows. That such applicant is a citizen of the United States of America. Two, that the applicant has been a bona fide resident of this state for at least 1 year prior to the date of such application of the county, 60 days next prior thereto. Number three is a good one. That the applicant is over 18 years of age and he is a person of good moral character. What does moral character mean? In our experience in NRA, would this mean that a woman who's had an abortion, not a person of high moral character? Women and minorities are always discriminated against in those places where licenses or permits are required for the use and ownership of firearms. Must be of temperate habits. We don't know what temperate means. Not addicted to intoxication, not addicted to the use of any controlled substance, and has not been convicted of any felony or of any offense involving the use on his part of such weapon in an unlawful manner, and shall prove to the satisfaction of court that he is gainfully employed in a lawful occupation. We've just eliminated housewives, retirees, and people on welfare. We can go on, and it does go on. The purpose or purposes for which the applicant desires to carry such weapon must be stated. If we're talking about a right of privacy, I think we've got got a case right here. I'll let you read this because it's included in your packet, the West Virginia case.
He left up the bond requirement, the fee.
Oh, I should get into that, right. But before, before such license shall be effective, such person shall pay to the sheriff and the court, shall so certify in its order granting the license the sum of $50, and shall also file a bond with the clerk of such court and a penalty of $5,000. And you wonder why the NRA went to court to help strike this thing down as unconstitutional, which it was. It was just too broad. If anybody can agree with that, then I think we have a more serious problem than I realize. I just like to point out also, in summary, Mr. Chairman, that I think that the real concern here that I've heard this morning in another testimony is what the state Supreme Court may or may not do in interpretation of this if indeed it's passed. And there are some points alluded to, particularly by the Assistant Attorney General, as to some of the real problems that may take place here. But I think basically we have to get real. The state Supreme Court in Alaska is not going to turn convicted felons on drug charges or anything else loose on the basis of this amendment. I think we just have to look at it in a real light. Any questions from the committee?
Thank you. Are there any questions? If not, the next person to testify is Ron Somerville.
Along teleconference line, the next witness to testify is Ron Somerville.
Excuse me just a second, Ron. We're going to do, I indicated, we have a majority caucus meeting at 10, and I indicated to them that I wanted to get at least all of the testimony of the people that were here today. And so I'm going to continue until they come down and indicate that they want to have us up there.
Chairman, thank you. My name is Ron
Somerville. Excuse me for interrupting.
That's all right. I'm representing the Alaska Outdoor Council, and I'll be brief, so you'll be able to easily make the caucus. I'm not going to try to repeat a lot of what's already been said. I would like to, I guess, from the standpoint of our membership, I represent 53 outdoor sportsman organizations in Alaska. We're not we're not an arm of some major group in Washington, D.C. We're exclusively Alaskan. We have a membership of approximately 12,000 members statewide. We're not just an urban organization. We have a lot of small affiliated groups throughout Alaska, including Kodiak and Tok and Delta and Wrangell and Petersburg and places like this. I think with this type of thing, I'd only encourage you to back up a bit. I think you can already see, it became apparent to me again, after 4 years, we seem to have created two very strong sides on this particular issue, and motions, I think, run a lot higher and are a lot more involved than actually the issues are. I think the key point I would like to stress is the general public believes they have the right individually to own and bear arms. And the question is, do we want them to have the right to vote on whether or not they believe their constitution should say that? And I guess I would say to you that the vast majority, if not 90-some percent of our membership, I haven't polled them, firmly believes that. And we have elevated this to one of our number one priorities for the next 2 years, is to get this in front of the voters. If they choose to vote it down, so be it. But we think the public in Alaska has a right to vote on this. It's been going on for 4 years, and I think the battlegrounds have somehow left the issue. I find it somewhat ironic when people, opponents of this type of wording, stand up and say, we want you to trust that the courts will interpret the other parts of the Constitution to protect your individual rights, and yet their colleagues stand here and say, we don't trust the courts when they get to interpreting this new language. So in one instance we're saying, trust the courts to do this, but we don't trust them to do that. Obviously, 30 years ago, we did not anticipate that there'd be this quick a change or that we somehow be lose the right individually to own and bear arms. So this thing, if it's worked all right, you know, not broken, don't fix it, I don't think really applies. Or why would 43 other states, regardless of their wording, choose to amend their constitution to somehow make it clearer that, in fact, it should be an individual right? And I think that's a major point. All I can say is from our organization standpoint, there is no interest, no intent whatsoever to change the felony laws, or the carry laws, or the mentally ill, or carrying firearms in liquor stores and this sort of thing. So I think the emotional arguments that this is going to do that, or if that it really is a real problem, then I think we should change the wording to make sure that doesn't happen. I really think a lot of the other arguments are window dressing. That the real issue is here, and I'm seeing more and more correspondence, and that the people that are opponents of this firmly believe it should be a collective and not an individual right. I think you've got to focus in on that, that they do not want it to be an individual right. I didn't believe that before, but I firmly do now because of the correspondence we're starting to see from the various groups. And that's the issue I think the Alaskan public wants the right to vote on. They don't agree with the enforcement office. I think generally Alaskans are 100% supportive of our enforcement people. But on this one issue, I think they disagree with them. They still would like to protect adequate laws to protect the public, but they want to protect their rights to own and bear arms. I have no other testimony. I think the group is pretty well given the NRA side. We support them. We may veer off a little bit on a particular portion of it, but we are going to push hard for this. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sumville. Are there any questions? Representative Zawacki.
Yeah, just a comment there, and I appreciate your comments about us believing in the courts and their interpretations. And the Department of Law sat here and talked about marijuana. It's unfortunate that the courts interpreted the law when they made marijuana constitutional. We were the only state in the union that did that. So you make a very good point in regards to we as legislators need to go out there protect the majority of the people, and that's exactly what this issue is. It's nice to come up with the leading hearts and talk about putting more restrictions on because of the abuses out there and the people who have abused the handguns. But the bottom line is we still need to protect Alaskans who are the majority and not make it further restrictive on them because of the further abuses. Maybe the court should go in and start being a little more stronger on the laws that we've got on the books to make sure that we can deter the criminals that are out there.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hannah.
Just a quick question. You talked about the two sides and how this has polarized people over the years. Would you consent to some of the additional language that has been suggested to ensure the fact that some of these regulations could still take place? Because I haven't been involved in this argument before. I haven't taken a side. I've been listening, and it's been a real education to me. But I lack some confidence. I find myself not agreeing with some of the interpretations that the court has recently decided. But I don't want to give up that right of the legislature. And I don't have any problem with the individual right to bear arms. You know, if that's what we're doing, if that's what we're guaranteeing. I'd certainly like to guarantee that without giving up all of these rights to the court to interpret, you know, with some broad language, just exactly what we meant. So is your side or the people of NRA absolutely intent that nothing else could be included in this language?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Hanley, we do not oppose additional language. I say we may veer somewhat from NRA in that respect, but and we agree with them, the general interpretation language that the courts have not anywhere, and I don't, this is a case in Colorado decided, I'm not even really familiar with it, that have never struck this down. But if they're in fact, we can precisely put in language here that says it doesn't exclude the right of the legislature to regulate felons or carry or mentally ill or in liquor stores or something, I'd hate to see it so broad, and I think our membership would, that we have a constitutional amendment that says the legislature can do anything.
Oh, yeah.